This is our second case today. Please be seated. Our second case today is Caceres, Manuel Caceres v. State. Ms. Dickinson and Ms. Pereira. Ms. Dickinson.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson. I represent Manuel Caceres. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll keep an eye on the clock for you.
In this case, there are 11 issues that we presented to the court for review today. All of them are meritorious individually or cumulatively. I'd like to start with issue 9 in jury instruction 25. Jury instruction 25 said, evidence has been presented that statements accusing the defendant of crimes charging the information were made in his presence at a time when he was not under arrest or in custody, and that such statements were neither denied nor objected to by him. It explains to the jury they can consider these statements if they decide they're true. They can consider the defendant's silence as an admission of truth of the statements. Now, we objected to this jury instruction. I didn't read it all. I just sort of summarized it. And we also objected to the testimony that the state introduced to support this instruction. Well, here's the problem. The state never introduced any statements that Manuel allegedly denied. At trial, the state had a detective testify to a conversation that R.C. allegedly had with Manuel. What the detective did is he wanted to trick Manuel into admitting the acts that he was going to be charged with. So he put R.C.'s phone on a speaker and he fed her questions to ask Manuel. Now at trial, state did not have R.C. testify to any statements that she said to Manuel, and the court did not allow the detective to testify to her statements. So all we had was the detective saying that he recognized the voice on the speaker as a male. He did not know Manuel's voice. And the only thing he said was, I do not want to talk about it. Clearly, this is not an admission of guilt, and certainly not a denial of anything, because we don't know from the record.
Ms. Dickinson, didn't Caceres object to Rosemary's statements being put in? And wasn't it Caceres who objected and said, I don't want you to admit what she said?
Well, yes, because they did not try to introduce it through R.C. They were introducing it through the detective, and it was hearsay. And the court agreed. Because it was hearsay, it was not allowed in. The state did not try to have R.C. come back on the stand and testify. So we don't know what R.C. would have said. The language in this jury instruction comes from NRS 51.035, subsection 3b, in part, where it says a statement of which the party has manifested adoption or belief in its truth is admissible under the hearsay exceptions. The problem is this instruction tells the jury that, you know, he made some statement, he really didn't, we don't know what it's in response to, and the state never established the foundation as to who was actually on the line. This in and of itself should be reason for reversal, but there's more. Issue 10, other bad acts in jury instruction 26. The other bad acts involved a stepdaughter who testified about an incident that had happened 20 years ago when she was 6 years old, and Manuel allegedly took her into the bedroom. Jury instruction 26 was the bad acts instruction that we objected to. Talks about evidence that the defendant may have committed offenses other than that for which he's on trial for. And it ends with that the jury can consider this for the limited purpose of proving the defendant's motive, intent, and propensity to commit sexual acts. Well, the defendant objected not only to the bad acts, but to the jury instruction, specifically the word propensity. This court has repeatedly prohibited the use of propensity evidence at trial, especially in sexual assault cases. What the state argued was that there was a change in the statute, NRS 45.045, because in 2015, the legislature amended it. They added a subsection that would appear to allow them to introduce any other alleged bad act. And in the supplemental authority that I presented to the court, I pointed out that this subsection was not in effect at that time, at the time of Manuel's case, because when I went back and looked at the legislative history, Manuel's case was commenced by criminal complaint on February 4th, 2014. And the legislature, when they enacted this subsection, said that it would only apply to cases commenced on or after October 1st, 2015. I know we all briefed about the merits of that subsection and how it should be construed, but actually, it shouldn't have even been used in this case. So that's another reason for this court to go ahead and reverse, because we do not allow propensity evidence in, and we told the jury that it's okay to consider that. Now, on issue eight, I talked about several jury instructions, one of which is a Santana instruction. It was not given to this jury, and that's a problem. That's reversible
error. Was it requested?
It was not. Neither party requested it, and the court did not contribute it on its own, because the court has a sui sponte duty to make sure jury instructions are correct if somebody forgets something. Under the coercion statute, NRS 207.190, there's a requirement of an immediate threat of physical force, and it requires the trier of fact to determine the immediacy of the threat. This, in turn, requires the jury to ascertain the viewpoint. How are we going to determine this? And in Santana, the court said it's a reasonable person determination. So the jury was never told this, and this error is not harmless, because the immediacy of the threat, or if there was any type of threat, was part of the argument between the defense and the state. The defense saying there was no threat, this act never happened, and the state saying, oh yes, there was. Now, so the jury and the state was arguing that you look at the threats under coercion or the possibility of a threat, and how RC perceived it. And that's not the law. Under Santana, would be a reasonable person. So that would be another reason to reverse this case. Another jury instruction, 23, particularity, which is based on the LaPierre case. That's a troubling instruction to give when the alleged victim here is over 18. And the instance it all happened when she was over 60, at least she says they did, the ones that were on trial for. LaPierre allowed the state to use a particularity instruction because a child may not know in particular when events occurred. So it allowed them to testify only if there was something particular about the incident so that we could determine it actually happened. That's important for any witness, but it should only be referenced with a child. I mean, there's no reason why RC could not testify with particularity about anything. Unfortunately, she didn't. And that was one of the problems we had in this case in arguing. We don't know exactly when the events happened because we had such a large time frame. We have another problem with another jury instruction flight, jury instruction 24. Manuel did not leave immediately. RC had left. She went with Steve. And it was about a week before police were called and there were allegations of sex crimes occurring. So there was really no flight. Yes, it's true he did leave eventually and go to Utah, but there was no proof that he left with a consciousness of guilt because police weren't investigating at the time. So that's another reason why this case should be reversed. Under issue five, it asks you to determine a hearing for NRS 207.193 subsection 1. When is the court supposed to have a hearing, or how are the procedures supposed to to be. We argue that because the state had not provided notice or requested a hearing at the time the jury came in, that the sexual motivation part of the coercion needed to be dismissed. Ultimately, the court disagreed. They said the information is all that they needed to provide for notice. A look at the statute suggests differently. If I could just briefly. Because the plain reading of the statute says after convicted. And just briefly on issue three, there are some issues about double jeopardy and unit prosecution. I don't know if the court has any questions. And issue five, the denial of the right of cross-examination. No questions? Okay. I'll save my rest of my time for rebuttal.
4 minutes, 4.5 minutes for the state.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amy Ferreira, and I am the Chief Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I'm representing the respondent in this matter. I'm going to address the issues in the same order as my counterpart did, starting with adoptive admissions. Case law is pretty clear that adoptive admissions can be presented so long as the state is able to prove that the individual heard those statements, understood those statements, and was given ample opportunity to respond to those statements. In this particular case, we had a detective who testified to a tactic that law enforcement frequently uses in these types of cases, whereby they ask the victim if they would be willing to call the accused and confront them with accusations. In this case, that's exactly what happened. The victim in this case asked to call the accused. She used her own cell phone. She dialed the phone herself and simply placed it on speakerphone. The state attempted to get into the exact words that the victim used on this phone call, but there was an objection as to hearsay, and the court sustained that objection. The state was not offering those statements to prove the truth of the matter asserted, which was the accusations, but merely to provide context to this conversation. The state was not allowed to do that. However, the state was able to provide some sort of surrounding circumstance in having the detective testify to what a pretext phone call was. And in his description, he says that that phone call is when a victim or alleged victim presents an accused with what she believes happened. So we knew for a fact that she was going to confront her alleged accuser. We had testimony to that fact. We also heard that the defendant said, "I don't want to talk to you about that right now." So the about that certainly had something to do with Rosemary accusing him, I'm sorry, the victim accusing him of the claims that she had made to the detective. Based on that, the case law is clear that he did not deny those accusations.
Is there any case that's even close to this fact scenario?
I personally haven't found a case that deals with this specific situation, but I think certainly we can take case law from similar situations and apply it to the facts of our case. I believe it was properly admitted in this case, and I would say that even if this court found, you know what, that was error, that it was harmless error. And I say that because this is not a situation where the accused confessed on the phone call. That would be a very different situation. Here he said, "I don't want to talk to you about that right now." So how much weight the jury put into a non-admission or a non-confession, I think certainly is harmless error given the totality of the circumstances and the level of proof that the state presented.
Do you think the jury instruction was proper?
I think the jury instruction was proper.
What's the case law that allows a jury instruction with those words, that wording, under these facts?
I show McGinnis v. State that the response lends itself to an inference that he agreed or adopted the admission. And that's what the state briefed as well.
So if somebody says, somebody calls me on the phone and says, "Justice Cherry, what about that sexual harassment you did?" And I say, "I don't want to talk about that." If I was charged with a crime, that's an adoptive admission when I say, "I don't want to talk about that"?
Well, you presented a fact pattern that was not the fact pattern in our case, in that somebody says, "What about?" Not, "Justice Cherry, you X, Y, and Z." So our fact pattern was confronting the accused with that statement, not asking if he wanted to talk.
I think the strongest argument is harmless error, but that's my own belief at this time. But that doesn't mean that's how it's going to be written. Go ahead to the next issue.
Thank you. The second issue I believe my counterpart raised was the other bad acts. And They took issue with the fact that there was propensity language. However, as the court is well aware, there was a change in the statute which took effect on October 1st of 2015, which added this subsection 3. And subsection 3 indicates that nothing shall be construed to prohibit the admission of evidence in a criminal prosecution for a sexual offense that a person committed another crime, wrong, or act that constitutes a separate sexual offense. That was particularly on point in our case.
Ms. Herrera, what about the timing of that statute and the allegation or the argument that this prosecution commenced before the effective date of that statute? Does that affect whether or not it should have been admitted?
I don't believe so, because certainly the trial was well after the date. I believe the hearing to admit the bad act was held after that date. So it's not as if a crime has occurred, and so we cannot charge an individual once a criminal complaint has been filed. This is a case where I'm sure the court remembers there was some delay in being able to apprehend the defendant in this case. So if we were going to say, oh, well, the date the crime was committed matters, it would way fall outside that time period. If we're going to say it's the date the criminal complaint was filed, that's a separate situation. But we have an individual who's put on notice that this statute is coming into effect. We have the hearing after it's come into effect. We have the jury trial after it's come into effect. So
what case would sustain that time difference? The statute says it's effective October 1st, 2015.
Correct.
This case is February 4th, 2014.
When the criminal complaint was filed.
Right.
Correct. But it wasn't used against the defendant at any point prior to the effective date of that statute.
But if I was advising this client in February when I saw the criminal complaint, I'd say, you know what, we don't have to worry about propensity because it isn't the law yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm worried about this timing.
And the defense and the state did have those conversations when the law came into effect to that very regard. So it's the state's position that time-wise, we were safe in having that bad act based on the date it came into effect. I would also point out that the defense in their argument sort of says, well, this can't be looked at as propensity evidence because that would make subsection 2 irrelevant. But it certainly doesn't, because subsection 2 deals with all crimes that are not listed specifically as sex offenses.
Now, the propensity, is it something that happened 20 years ago?
I'm sorry?
Is the propensity the thing that happened 20 years ago?
The other bad acts, yes. And that's with the stepdaughter.
I mean, it's clear the legislature intended that type of evidence in these situations is admissible. Question about the age of it would go to the judge's balancing in terms of the probative value of that. What of the prior, the 20-year-old offense, was the nature of that offense similar? Was the conduct similar or just the relationship?
It was similar, though not exact. Certainly in the case in front of the court, there was much more conduct than in the case 20 years ago. And part of that was because that victim only had specific memories of one event. She said, it happened more than one time, but I only have a specific memory of this event. So it's similar in so much as in our case, we had instances where the defendant is trying to take the victim from the bath or the shower and perform acts on her. Same in the other bad acts. Child is in the shower, she's taken from the shower and placed into a room. Very similar to in our case. She's also forced to masturbate the penis of the defendant, same as in our case. There's a familial relationship in that it's a parent-child, same as in our case. So they are very similar. They are not exactly on point because we have so much more conduct in our case.
And did the court admit it under the propensity piece of the statute or under intent motive? I mean, under what theory did the court admit that 20-year part?
The state requested that there be a finding that it was admissible under three separate theories. One is the propensity, one is motive, and one is intent. Simply because the state doesn't know what...
Why would you use propensity when it's the time frame is not in accord with the statute?
And that wasn't the state's position. I didn't see in the legislative history any definitive language that would say, if your criminal complaint was filed on a certain date, then you're out of luck. I didn't see that in the legislative history. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It just wasn't briefed.
But if you had other reasons, why would you take a chance and put propensity in when it's a contested issue that hasn't been decided by the Supreme Court?
Well, and I think
you didn't need it.
I think we did need it because
why?
defense argued in their briefing is that, well, we didn't argue it was an accident, so it shouldn't come in under motive or intent. We're not saying he accidentally touched her, so it shouldn't have come in under those theories. And that was what the state was concerned about. So we wanted to make sure we had a ruling that this evidence was admissible under any theory that might possibly become relevant in the course of this trial. And that's why the request was made in the manner that it was.
Well, what you've done is you teed up a big issue. That even no matter what we roll, I can see en banc reconsideration no matter what in this case because of this issue with the statute. And the three of us will make our decision, but it'll come out to the seventh. I know it will with that issue of the statutory interpretation. This is a big issue, this propensity. Just a warning to the district attorney's office.
Could you address something for me, the failure to administer the oaths prior to questioning, the failure to admonish, and how our decision in Barrel may come into that analysis?
Yes, as the court's aware, under NRS 16.030 subsection 5, it does require the court to give promise of the jury veneer to tell the truth before any questioning occurs. That didn't happen in this case. That was error. The court should have given the oath immediately before asking any questions. However, I point out to the court that essentially there were only three questions asked prior to that. It was, had anyone had a felony without their rights being restored? Was anybody not a U.S. citizen? And was anyone acquainted with people related to the case, be it the parties, the witnesses, or the court staff? The court did rule in Barral that failure to give that oath was an infringement on the Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury. That's not this case. So in the Barral case, there was no oath given, period. In this case, a mere three questions were asked before that oath was given. In the Barral case, the parties approached and said, Your Honor, the oath, and the court still refused to give it.
That is there happen. Any objection here?
No, no objection. Nobody.
How did it happen, though, that all of a sudden he gave the oath?
All of a sudden, it seems that he remembered, if I'm being candid with the court. So I don't see any ill intent. I think certainly under the circumstances with the court that was deciding this case, they probably were very aware that they needed to give the oath, and it was just a lapse of memory. I don't think there was anything nefarious, certainly, about it. And once that triggered in the memory, it was like, oh, I need to give the oath, and then the oath was given. So I think certainly this case is distinguishable from Barral because we have something that was very minor that could have been cured if either party was concerned. And furthermore, there were questions asked down the line after the oath was given that I think addressed everything but being a U.S. citizen.
Why didn't he just re-ask the questions?
I don't know the answer to that.
Common sense. I mean, does it escape the 8th Judicial District Court? And they're looking for us to say, why didn't you just, if there's three questions, ask the questions again.
Right. And in hindsight, the state absolutely should have requested that. So that's on the state as well. But certainly, I think.
Could you talk about two issues? You've got about 3 minutes left. The particularity instruction and the flight instruction.
Yes. So I'll start with the flight instruction. The law is clear that the flight instruction is appropriate if there's evidence that flight occurred. Not that somebody was planning to flee or had an intent to flee, but that there was actual flight. So in this particular case, we have a testimony that the victim left, and that very shortly thereafter, the police were called, and the defendant made up this story about bikers, looked for his daughter for 2 hours, then took off to another state. He left so quickly that he left all his tools behind, and there was testimony that that was his livelihood, that he did construction. He left a barbecue behind, and he headed straight to Utah. It's interesting that these efforts to delay prosecution and arrest, in fact, in this case, did delay prosecution and arrest, because it took some time before anybody was able to locate the defendant. So certainly in this case, the state was able to prove that there was some evidence of flight in the haste with which the defendant left. The circumstances that he explained to his son why they were leaving, the fact that he left everything behind, and then there was some testimony later on that he would call when the detective wasn't there, and that he knew he was calling when the detective wasn't there, further evidence that he was trying to evade law enforcement, and that's particularly what he did in this case.
Where did he go in Utah?
I believe he fled with that same trailer that the acts in this case occurred.
Listen.
I'm just curious as to how far he got.
Yeah, he got to Utah. I think that was about it. I think the court also asked me to address the particularity instruction.
Yes.
I believe in this case that that instruction was covered by other instructions, and I think that was a pretty similar fact pattern to that in the Rose case, where they said that if there is another instruction or set of instructions that kind of covers the issue of particularity and reasonable doubt and things of that nature, then it was an error not to give that instruction. And that was certainly the state's argument in this case, that that instruction wasn't given, but it was covered by other instructions, so that it did not need to be given in this instance. Does the court have any other specific questions or topics that you'd like me to?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
If I could begin with issue one, the jury selection errors in Burrell. I'm aware that this court recently, a few months ago, heard argument on the Morgan Moran case, I believe, which is a similar issue. Here we only have a few questions, where in the other case it was all the questions. And I want to suggest that the prosecutor is being very generous in saying that the court just simply forgot. The reason I say that is because Burrell had already come out. I would suggest that maybe the court didn't want to do that. We've seen this in other cases. We see the court here not wanting to admonish the jurors, even though there's a statute that says that.
Why would the court, in your opinion, administer the oath after three questions?
I think it was five questions, and I don't know.
Isn't that a little contrary to your argument?
Pardon me?
Isn't that a little contrary to your argument that he just didn't want to administer the oath?
I will tell you, I've seen it in other cases. I'm not sure why he would ask five or six questions and then administer the oath, because he knows about Farrell.
Did the trial attorney say, Judge, now that you've administered the oath, could you re-ask the question?
No, they didn't, and I think the prosecutor admitted they didn't either, so there's error. I mean, that wasn't the only jury selection statute he didn't follow.
There were numerous issues with the way he selected the jury. None of those were objected to. That's correct.
But there's so many of them, I think that it's almost cumulative plain error. If I could go back to...
Was it just inexperience of the public defender, or what's happening? I know you have training programs, and we have the Indigent Defense Commission, and the Right to Counsel, a legislative commission. It's just common sense.
I understand what the court's saying. I think that the trial court has a responsibility to follow the rules, and I put blame on them. I mean, that's their job. Our job is objecting and trying to make sure everything is, you know, the court has a responsibility, and I don't think it occurred here that they fulfilled their responsibility. I like to talk about that flight instruction briefly. I find it difficult to see that somebody flew, but they've given the detective their telephone number and they're contacting. I mean, it just, to me, doesn't go. Clearly, he didn't fly, didn't just leave to flee prosecution. He was in contact with the detective. I thought he was with his family. And they knew his license number and his RV. He didn't try to hide any of that. He's gone back and forth to Utah in the past, so I don't think there was any flight.
But he went back to Utah, not forth, right? I mean, he left. And the prosecutor's statements about the facts, about leaving his tools, kind of the abrupt nature of the travel. While there's contrary facts to that, which you've already, doesn't that go to argument in whether or not the jury should get the instruction?
I think him leaving his tools and a barbecue pit, which we're not even sure if it even works, it does not indicate flight, because it could also indicate he just forgot his tools. I mean, this man has gone back and forth from California and Utah and Las Vegas in this RV, so it may have been something he just simply forgot. With regard to the other bad acts, the prosecutor said something about the defense and the state having some kind of conversation about the statute. That's not in the record, so I don't know anything about that or if it even ever happened. She said something about the girl who testified to the other bad acts had other incidents but no specific memories or had lots of memories. That's not in the record. I'm not aware of that. We're only aware of the bad act is what they presented, and what they put in the record was one time when the girl was six, and clearly it was nothing at all like the allegations here with a girl who was 16, 17, or 18. And the state didn't really present it as the same. You know, the only thing that was similar is that it was a stepdaughter, alleged. With regard to the adoptive admissions and the jury instruction, it's difficult to see harmless error here when you look at the wording of that instruction. It really suggested that he had agreed that he had committed these acts. The evidence was not overwhelming because there was a lot of discrepancy with her testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Court, thanks, Ms. Ferrario and Ms. Dickinson. Excellent argument on both of you. Excellent arguments. Excellent briefs. Thank you.